Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know. Tonight's program is co-presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org and follow Inforum's Twitter account at twitter.com/InforumSF. I'm Phil Bronstein. I'm the editor-at-large at Hearst Newspapers, and I am your moderator for this evening. I'm sure you are all here to hear about the First Amendment. Good. We have a real treat tonight. We have the co-authors of the new book, One Nation Under Sex. David Eisenbach is a professor of American history at Columbia University, where he also teaches philosophy and literature. He's the creator and writer of what clearly was a precursor to this book, a two-hour History Channel special called The Beltway Unbuckled, which you might guess from the title. It's about presidential sex in U.S. history. He's the author of Gay Power, an American Revolution, Politically and Culturally Transformational Study of Gay Power. He also co-wrote The Kingmakers, How the Media Threatens Our Security and Democracy, which makes me as a member of the media feel very menacing right now. Our other guest today is Larry Flint, so I'm sure you'll be shocked to hear that our topic will be sex, a subject which Larry has tried and largely succeeded in making unavoidable in American culture for the last 35 years. You can give him a hand for that. Mr. Flint, who I can confess that I know and like a great deal, was a former Kentucky moonshiner and son of a sharecropper who built outrageous X-rated parody from an $1,800 investment in a bar into a net worth estimated in the hundreds of millions. His hustler empire includes clubs, publications, film, and a poker joint. All that after running away from home and joining the Army at 15 with a phony birth certificate. Larry was briefly born again, then apparently unborn, and is now an atheist. He once said the Bible was the biggest piece of crap ever written. Larry was partially paralyzed during a 1978 assassination attempt, and he has turned that into a cultural statement. If you notice the gold wheelchair, it's quite something. He once wore American flag diapers to court and shouted obscenities at the Supreme Court justices and won the case. I watched his deposition tapes from decades ago the other night when he was being sued by Reverend Jerry Falwell, and they are hilarious definition, the definition of irreverent. And, of course, not surprisingly, he spent time in jail. His million-dollar offer for political sex scandal information forced the resignation of the incoming Republican House Speaker Livingston in the middle of the Clinton impeachment hearings. He once ran for governor calling himself the pornographer who cares. And unlike our last governor, at least we would have known what we were getting. Oh. If there ever was a you-know-what disturber, and you all know what, in part thanks to him, it's Larry Flint. So please join me in welcoming Professor Eisenbach and Larry Flint.
David and I are on the road with this thing, and we're working pretty well together. So I'll talk a few minutes about the book, and then I'll kick it over to David to discuss some of his favorite stories in it. We'll go back and forth and then open it up for question and answers. When I decided I wanted to do this particular book, I reached out for David because he was a history professor at Columbia, and I felt nobody would want to read a history book written by a pornographer. So I got David involved, and we've had it's like a hand and glove relationship. We work very well together. But my primary reason for wanting to get involved is we were having all these sex scandals in our own society, politically that is, and they're happening like about every 6 months. And I thought, what was going on with the founding fathers, you know? Was the same sort of thing happening? Was this happening throughout our history? And we found that it was. And it was just inane and vicious, and they would use these rumors and innuendos to attack each other in their various campaigns, whether it was Thomas Jefferson or Alexander Hamilton. And down through history, it's absolutely no different than it is today. Now, one of the startling stories that I find out that's very important is, ever since the founding of our nation, there's always been these rumors about Thomas Jefferson. No one thought that the founder of our nation, the man who drafted the Declaration of Independence, would actually sleep with his slave girl and father six children. But it happened. Unfortunately, it was just a rumor for 200 years. It wasn't until 1998, when DNA had been perfected, that we were able to prove that Jefferson was the father of her children. But and it comes right on down. David, you want to talk?
Yeah, if you want to say something?
No.
Feel free. All right. So I read this book, and I have to say was shocked, and very little shocks me these days. But you miss quite a few presidents. It seems as though almost every president that we think about, we don't think about Harding that often, but most of the other presidents that you talk about and write about, we think about. But does the book suggest to us that Calvin Coolidge, Harry Truman, or Barack Obama, or Teddy Roosevelt, who had no absence of testosterone, somehow managed to escape this, you know, this speed trap that all these guys up to and including our former governor?
We're not perfect, Phil. You know, we couldn't get them all. We didn't have Sherlock Holmes helping us. You know.
We also didn't want to write a book that was just a collection of, you know, one sexcapade after another involving the presidents and the first ladies. We wanted to write a book that connected the personal and the private to the political. So if the story was something that was just, you know, Chester A. Arthur's mistress, we weren't interested in that. We wanted to see how the mistress maybe was involved in policy. And if that was the case, if she had an effect on policy, she made it into the book. So that's why we don't cover every single president with a dalliance.
Do you think every single president had a dalliance? I mean, it does seem to be a disease of the powerful.
I think there's a lot we don't know that will remain that way. But, you know, you can... you can't make a story out of thin air, you know. All you can do is do your research and see what you come up with.
Yeah. We could kind of safely say about half of them are on record somewhere as having a mistress or a lover outside the relationship.
Do you think this is I'm not going to say a disease because I don't like the imagery, but do you think that this is really a function of power and the convergence of power and politics and ego?
Yeah, I think that politics attracts a certain personality type, right? They're not motivated by money. They're motivated by this desire to get in front of the crowd and get some feedback, right? So that's a kind of needy personality type. Then couple that with the opportunity. When you are a man and when you are speaking in front of large audiences, chances are there's a woman or two in the crowd who's interested if you do it well, and these guys do it well. So that and traveling a lot opens up a lot of opportunities so that you see, for example, the divorce rate of the incoming freshman class of congressmen, they have like a 30% divorce rate after the first 2 years in office. Well, there's a reason for that. And so opportunity and personality type have a lot to do with it.
You know, every single modern-day president that I've been involved in outing, whether it was Livingston, whether it was Vendor, the Mr. Absence in the Senate, Senator Ed Hooker's in Washington, D.C., and Louisiana. And, you know, we were not going. We were accused of, all you want to do is just expose the guy's sex life. That wasn't it at all. It was just the hypocrisy that was there. But in all of these people that I've studied over the years, some of them have been inconsequential congressmen, some of them have been governors, many of them have been U.S. senators. I find that there was a common trait with him, with them. They had a huge ego. As Donald Trump would say, mammoth. You know, they had a huge ego. And in order to feed that ego, they did it with the conquest of young women or men. Now, I found that was prevalent with every single one of them that we wound up exposing over the years.
Now, they were winners, as Charlie Sheen would say. It's a shame we're talking about the convergence of sex and politics right at this moment when there's so little going on in the news about that. But I wonder, you know, redemption always seems possible in politics. You write about a number of presidents who have redeemed themselves or did redeem themselves after being outed having affairs and so forth and hookers and all the other stuff. Alexander Hamilton confessed to an affair. So did Jefferson. Grover Cleveland talked about his activities. And there was a quote in your book, purity of character after a period of political existence is not necessary for public patronage. In other words, you can be a hound and somehow get away with it. And now we have Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I'm wondering, he's come out and confessed 10 years later about fathering a child. He seems to fall into the category, Larry, that you were both talking about.
Exactly. And I was asked that question earlier today. People could forgive Bill Clinton. They will never forgive Arnold Schwarzenegger because he was a dog, you know. He picked on the housekeeper, been under his roof for 20 years. And it, well, you know, it didn't, wasn't that just that one time that she happened to get pregnant. It was probably a regular occurrence. So, it's almost as bad as John Edwards, who was having an affair while his wife was dying of cancer. There's some things that you will not have redemption in. I think Arnold's, I don't know what's going to happen to his career, but any sort of personal redemption he's looking for, he's not going to get.
I think his contract with Disney is probably in jeopardy right now. Aside from that, he'll probably be able to survive.
You know, one of the main themes of the book, obviously, is how sex and sex scandals and sex blackmail and so forth has really altered history. But let me just go through, give me one second here to go through some of the things that came out of the book when I read it. You had Frederick von Steuben, who was gay, changed the course of the War of Independence. You had the Truth of a Defense for the Press, which was crucial for us, created by Alexander Hamilton, originating in sex scandals. You had the Jefferson-Madison sex scandals that led to the War of 1812. Dolly Madison, we don't even talk about her.
That's just the first chapter.
Peggy Eden affair during Andrew Jackson's presidency played an important role in how the Civil War unfolded. James Buchanan was gay, and his male lover was a big pro-slavery proponent, and that affected that. The U.S. absence from the League of Nations was led to the rise of Hitler, was a function of Woodrow Wilson and some of the things he was doing. Lincoln's possible homosexuality made him more sympathetic when it came to issues of slavery. Eleanor Hick, who was very close to Mrs. Roosevelt, changed the way first ladies operated. I mean, we could go on. Ike created executive privilege, presidential executive privilege, to avoid sexual information getting out. There was no J. Edgar Hoover investigation of the mob because they could sexually blackmail him because he was apparently not a cross-dresser, but gay. And then you go into Kennedy. The whole Kennedy chapter is shocking, the most shocking, I think, because it's the most detailed, that had his brother not basically deported, silenced, bought off a variety of women, professional and otherwise, that Kennedy might not have gone to Dallas because he would be getting himself out of trouble in Washington, potentially led to his killing. So other than the moon landing, what is not attributable in American history in the key moments to sex?
Right. Well, we don't attribute it all to sex, right? The Second World War and America's inability to join the League of Nations was not caused as a result of Woodrow Wilson's sexual affair with Edith Galt. But we are saying in each of these cases that sex played a major role in how the history unfolded. So that the historians who have traditionally turned a blind eye to the private lives and the sex lives of presidents and first ladies because they don't consider it serious history have missed a very important component of the larger history of America. And this book is the corrective of that, bringing the sex back into the politics.
I mentioned Kennedy, and Larry, you have particular, I think, respect for the Kennedy era. You've talked about it, it was an era of hope. I saw an interview you did where you said the revelations about the Kennedys, and they're really, I think you should buy the book for that.
It was devastating for me to work on the chapters with Kennedy because I grew up in that area, the Kennedy mystique, Camelot, area where everybody loved their country. You could accomplish whatever you believed. And it was sort of that feel-good generation.
Definitely they were feeling good in that administration.
And Kennedy, I think, was part of that. So there's no doubt had President Kennedy lived, everything that's come out would have come out and even more. But I want to explain to you what bothered me. He's President of the United States, the most powerful man in the world. If he wants a woman, he's not going to have any trouble. Why did he have to go with the starlets like Marilyn, Angie Dickinson, Marlena Dietrich, and on and on, a laundry list of Hollywood conquests that he was interested in. And these rendezvous were not very well thought out or planned. It was just careless. First of all, I am the first person to defend a philandering president. I think if you can fight two wars, balance a budget at the same time, you deserve to sleep with whoever you want to. But he just wasn't being cool about it. And then
You forgot the German, East German spy that he was sleeping with.
Yeah, well, that East German spy almost did it, man. I'll let David address that in a minute. But one second, one other thing I wanted to add. His wife, Jacqueline, and First Lady, she was... Women in this country thought of her as royalty. Her approval ratings were through the roof. Jackie could do no wrong. She was having affairs even before the president was assassinated and continued them afterwards. And one of them being with Bobby, the president's brother, who later on was assassinated. So I don't know how, you can get any more tackier than that.
There was something tackier than that. Jackie, according to your book, was sleeping with Aristotle Onassis, who she'd been sleeping with before her husband died, 2 days after he died, in the White House. Or something going on.
He's invited
you
up to the
You want to talk about the German spy? He brought that up. And going to the Hoover thing.
Jackie, real quick. We give a whole chapter to Jackie because it's a much more complicated story than the story we have been taught. And we present her not as she's been traditionally presented as a victim, but she's also a player. right? And that's not something that traditionally we've liked to have seen in our first ladies. But as you're going to see when you read this book, they are complicated and in many cases voracious in their sex lives also, not just the guys. But getting back to Ellen Romish, in 1963, the Republicans had already begun to gear up for the 1964 re-election campaign that Kennedy intended to run. And they were about to smear the administration with lax morals. They had already begun to develop dossiers on the president's sex life. And one of the women that they knew about was a woman named Ellen Romish, who is from East Germany and a prostitute who frequented the White House swimming pool parties that the Kennedys would throw every once in a while. Well, Senator Whispering Willie Williams, this prude from Delaware, intended to bring Ellen Romish into the Senate chamber and grill her on her relationship with the president. Now, if that happened, it's quite possible that Kennedy would have been impeached, not only on the morals issue, but because the FBI had begun to investigate her as a possible communist spy. So here you have the president of the United States carrying on an affair with a prostitute who happens to be from a communist country. You can kind of see how this could have doomed the Kennedy presidency. So how do you stop the U.S. Senate from going forward with an investigation? Well, there was one man who could stop the U.S. Senate, and that was J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI. Of course, J. Edgar Hoover wanted a concession. So he says to the Kennedys, okay, I'll stop the U.S. Senate, but you got to give me two things. Number one, make me FBI director again. And number two, give me written approval and permission to wiretap and bug Martin Luther King Jr. The FBI then takes that and then records Martin Luther King Jr. having his own affairs. You know, Washington was an absolute cesspool in large part because these guys were not exposed in the press, but they were sexually blackmailing each other. And J. Edgar Hoover was at the forefront of this entire operation.
You think that's really unlike today?
I think it's, you know, there's no J. Edgar Hoover. You know, when you read that Hoover chapter, here's a man who used sexual blackmail against every congressman, senator, Supreme Court justice, and president to undermine the U.S. Constitution for 47 years. Right? He had a government within the government.
And here's Hoover's technique. He didn't necessarily go through political channels if he wanted to destroy somebody's career. Walter Wenchel, a well-known radio commentator in New York, was friends with Hoover because of the information he could get. And so was the columnist Drew Pearson, very famous columnist in Washington. Well, when he wanted to leak a story, he went to one of them. And it was so, he could be so deadly. I mean, the career could just evaporate overnight. That's how powerful Hoover was. And, you know, you got to think about it. Here's a guy who stayed in power as director of the FBI for almost 50 years. You know something had to be going on there. And each president that would come in that would try to find Nixon wanted to find him and couldn't because he had too much, you know. Every president that came into office, they... there was nothing they could do about it because Hoover had so much information.
In fact, Roosevelt, I think, maybe was the first president who actually used Hoover, right?
Yeah, well, and that's it. I mean, Hoover was also very useful to presidents if they needed to have something shut down. So he worked with presidents and not only against them. And Roosevelt was the one who really opens up the door, Franklin Roosevelt, to giving J. Edgar Hoover all this surveillance power.
And Roosevelt, sort of contrary to type, public type, also was so upset about his wife Eleanor having an affair with a military officer that didn't he decreed that everybody who knew about this should be shipped to the Pacific the front lines.
Okay, all right. Yes. Well, at least
that picture of Roosevelt.
That is the report in Eleanor Roosevelt's FBI file. Now, whether Franklin Roosevelt actually said these things is unknown because a lot of the problem with basing a history on the FBI files is there are a lot of lies and a lot of misinformation in there. But it didn't matter because everybody knew that even if the stuff in your FBI file wasn't true, it still could destroy you and would destroy you if it got to the public. So the problem is no one could criticize J. Edgar Hoover, even though he is the director of the FBI and he refuses to acknowledge the existence of the National Mafia Syndicate. At a time when the mafia is taking over America's unions, flooding America's cities with heroin, becoming this huge menace, he's running around chasing after communists. So no journalist, no congressman, no senator could criticize the FBI director, even though every cop on the street knew something was really wrong here.
Well, and wasn't that because the mob essentially had information about him being gay? And in fact, while we think about the 50s and the McCarthy era as being, let's go after the communists, really it was, let's go after the gay people who were in government.
Yeah. That's right, because there were a lot more gay people in government than communists.
You know, Larry, I mentioned the Kennedy thing, not just because it's a fascinating period, and as described in your book, but because I'd heard you say that, you know, it was sad what happened and it was difficult for you to write that chapter. On the other hand, you got a pretty huge boost early in your career by printing naked pictures of Jackie O sunbathing. That was like a big moment for you. So you didn't seem to be worried about that part.
No, that's when I was young, hungry, and foolish. when I first started Hustler, I got access to some new photographs of Jackie, which was taken on a private island of Scorpios. That's on Assas Island. And what makes a funny even story, the story even funnier, the Italian paparazzi that took the pictures, he was over here trying to sell them to Playboy and Penthouse, the other competing magazines, wanted millions of dollars for them. Nobody was interested because it was an election year. Nobody wanted to touch it. I said, I'll take it. I wound up getting the photographs for $18,000, and I made over $20 million the first year with those photographs, continuously going back to press and back to press. And they said the original issues are collector's items that are worth into the thousands of dollars.
That's better than a hedge fund. Okay, so maybe it's just me, but why is it so hard to believe that Richard Nixon had an affair?
Well, that's David's baby, okay?
Well, the FBI believed he did. And not only that, the FBI believed that Nixon had an affair with a Chinese communist spy in the mid-1960s. And when Nixon comes into office, J. Edgar Hoover presents him with photographs from this investigation when Nixon was on business trips over in Hong Kong. And Nixon is absolutely anxious about this because he decides that he wants to open up a domestic spy operation coming out of the White House. He doesn't want to have to go through Hoover. Well, Hoover vetoes this, and Nixon's trying to figure out some way in which he can fire Hoover. But we have him on tape talking about how if he fires the old man, Hoover will bring down the whole temple and me too. That's a quote. The whole temple, meaning the entire U.S. government. So there's a huge consequence to this affair, which if the American public knew, certainly would have put a kind of new angle on Nixon opening up relations with China.
It's scary to think about how much our society hangs by a thread of weird desires. Larry, you've said that after survival, that sex is the second biggest desire. But after reading this book and after the headlines of the last couple of days and weeks, some of these guys don't care about their survival. I mean, I'm not talking about they're going to choke themselves to death in some autoerotic play, but I'm suggesting that these guys engage in highly self-destructive behavior, whether it's John Edwards or Arnold Schwarzenegger or any of the people in the book.
But that's because, we use sex to communicate with more than any other medium, but we still understand it less. And it is a desire for survival which is stronger, and then the next is sex. So if the second most important thing in everybody's life is sex, boy, you think we'd know a little bit more about it. But we don't, you know. We just seem to do what's natural, and that seems to get us in trouble all the time.
Well, it gets us in trouble here. I mean, you know, I was struck by the Benjamin Franklin discussion in your book that his behavior, I mean, he was a pretty randy guy in through his 70s and 80s. But he goes to France, and it's kind of that's what people do. And I was a John Adams who was a sort of prudish and very upset about this fact that, well, how can this guy Franklin get away with this stuff in France? He'd never get away with it here. And today we have the former head of the IMF who, I have to say, if you haven't heard the Bill Maher line about this guy, he said the other day, this is the defense lawyer for the former head of the IMF said, he's not a flight risk. He was arrested on a flight. But what about this notion that we are maybe the inheritors of our Puritan society background and we haven't advanced much?
Well,
or are French people just crazy?
Well, no. What it is America has a knee-jerk attitude about sex. And this is all ingrained with our religious teachings and the way that we're brought up. Everybody has ambivalent feelings about sex. Everybody has guilt and don't know how to deal with it. The Europeans are much more laid back about sex. Look, they know their politicians are having affairs. That's why they have their 3-hour lunches all the time, you know. But I would like the day to come where Americans were not so uptight about sex and realize it is one of the greatest assets that was ever given to us. So we should enjoy it and not be placed on a guilt trip for the rest of our life.
Yeah. And never again allow ourselves to get sucked into a sex scandal that just consumes the political discussion for a couple of years, as we did with the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Good luck on that one.
Yeah, well, according to the 9/11 Commission report, the Clinton administration was so inhibited by accusations of wagging the dog in its campaign to kill Osama bin Laden in the late 1990s that they pulled back and didn't launch a more aggressive war against al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And that's the 9/11 Commission report. So, you know, here is once again, you know, we've got to get over this hyper-puritanicalism because we've got some real crises on our hands. We got to focus on national security and economics and not fun in the Oval Office.
But isn't sort of peeping through windows further this kind of stigmatization of sex? I mean, you know, this is a great book, and I encourage everybody to buy it and read it. But, I mean, what you're basically doing is saying, you know, there is no privacy. And certainly in the days of Facebook, there is no privacy. But doesn't obsessive interest and curiosity, which much of the public has about sex and the sex lives of powerful and famous people, further stigmatize the subject and therefore makes it impossible for us to evolve in the way that you're talking about?
I don't think it stigmatizes it. I think that the more sex scandals we have, and now we've counted, we average one every 6 months. I mean, Arnold hit it right on cue with his latest go-around. So we are becoming more and more jaded, and that's a good thing. David Vitter, as Larry brought up, is senator from Louisiana, caught with the D.C. madam. The man won a landslide victory with the Republican Party down there. You know, we're becoming Newt Gingrich, right? Thinks he can become president of the United States, you know, a well-known adulterer, right? If that's possible.
He's been married more times than Larry King, and he's still running for president.
So, you know, if this is possible, then I think the change has come, and that's a good thing, because while we're not going to sort of be uninterested in the sex, we just won't be as obsessed with it. That's the hope, anyway.
Well, let me ask each of you this question. Do you believe in monogamy?
Huh?
Do you believe in monogamy?
You know what makes you monogamous poverty. I think it's much easier for a man to be monogamous than for a woman. I'm not trying to create a double standard here. I'm just stating as a matter of fact that it seems to be very difficult for the men to be able to uphold that standard. And I'm not Freud. I don't have the answer.
Professor? Spotlight's on you.
Yeah, I think, you know, Larry Flynn is right about it. Yeah, definitely. Monogamy is difficult.
All right, well, I'm going to do everyone a favor and not pursue that
further.
Women play a huge role in this book, and obviously not just as subjects, as hookers and as mistresses and so forth, but really... it's interesting to think about particularly the women who were cheated on and sometimes themselves did the cheating as well. And I was about to say Hillary Clinton, but I don't mean to conflate those two statements. But, you know, you have these women who stood by their men, in a sense. A lot of them did. A lot of the wives of presidents past have. Hillary Clinton did. Maria Shriver did in 2003. Probably regrets it today. And then a lot of them sort of traded that for some power.
Yeah.
And I think that the idea that Hillary Clinton was sort of the first co-steward first lady, you know, you had Edith Galt, Warren Harding's wife was counting delegates at the convention. You know, Jackie Onassis was an extraordinary manipulator. So, you know, the women come out as having a certain kind of power in this. In these relationships.
That's right. Ellen Wilson, Eleanor Roosevelt, they all make their compromise because they believe that, you know, once we get into the Oval Office, we're going to do good. Right? They're not just, you know, standing by their man just because they love them. They want the power too. And they're powerful actors and not just victims.
I'm wondering, you know, as we talk about this, whether we are not better off in the days, I would say, in the first 50 years of the 1900s, where go up through the Kennedy administration, where Bobby Kennedy could call his friends in the press and say, or enemies in the press and say, don't run that story, and they wouldn't run it.
Right.
In the days when, I mean, there was a politician in San Francisco, I will not reveal who it is, many years ago, who we found out as reporters had a very active nightlife. He was married, the kids. And two reporters went out and followed this guy around for 2 weeks and filled their notepads with the most eye-opening kind of activity. You know, 3 a.m. in a Volkswagen in the shadow of Grace Cathedral. But we decided at that time, again, 20 years ago, that the politician showed up for work every morning and did his job. Therefore, what he did on his own time, however scandalous, was not a story. Would we be better off going back to those days?
Look, there's a saying called sunshine is the best transparency. Now, we always hear our government agencies talk about transparency. Problem is you never see it. Now, I think the time is eroded. The time is gone where we're going to be able to ever regain many of the individual liberties and personal freedoms that we gained with the very liberal Warren Court back in the 60s. I think we might as well accept that because of companies like Google and Facebook that... You know, privacy, the loss of privacy is what we pay for this technology. It's a terrible thing for me to concede because I feel as strongly about the privacy issue as I do about the First Amendment issue. But, you know, life changes. Technology changes things. But the problem really is not the technology. It's not the lifestyle of the American people. American people have to become brave enough to create a revolving door in Washington, D.C. and keep that thing going each election. If you vote for somebody and he doesn't perform the way you think he should, then the next 2 years or the next 6 years, you know, you vote him out again. But Americans have so much apathy that they don't feel that they can make a difference, so they sit back and do nothing. Millions don't even vote at all. Well, that's a disservice to yourself and, you know, to your friends. I don't know why I got wandering off on that subject. I'm sorry.
On the issue of the changes in technology and how that has opened up the sex lives of presidents, of politicians, as never before, one of the interesting things that we talk about in the book is how with the founding fathers and in the early 19th century, the press was filled with stories about the sexual affairs and the private lives of presidential candidates and first ladies. It's not until the 20th century, with the rise of the national security state and the professionalization of journalism, that journalists begin to see themselves as part of the establishment, that they were there to kind of guard against any threats to the president, including gossip about his personal life. That continues and intensifies in the Cold War, but once the Cold War is over, then there's this sense of, well, the heat's off, right? America is the best nation on earth, where they got no threats, stock market's up, let's have a fun little sex scandal involving the president. We got burned by that. And our hope in this book is, in a weird way, yes, we're returning to the days of the pamphleteers, now called bloggers. But we have to have the maturity to handle this power, to handle this information, so that the next time we do have a sex scandal involving the president, it doesn't occupy the country's attention for 2 years.
Maturity. That's interesting. You know, some people argue this issue they call character. And I agree with Larry what you said about hypocrisy. I think in California, voters have proven that they'll accept lying, cheating, and stealing, but they do not like hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing. But I think in general, when you talk about sort of sex scandals and the doors and windows that you've opened in this book and other people open on a daily basis, there's really a question. Does it reflect a character, a personality? I mean, let's talk about John Edwards, who not just let down his family, but let down millions of people who believed he was someone he was not. You quote Joseph Kennedy in this book as saying, telling his sons, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, it's who people think you are.
Right.
So is there a character issue that we ought to take from this kind of behavior and apply it to what kind of leader they would be? And before you answer that, we're going to take questions in a couple minutes, so if you want to start lining up behind these two microphones, please feel free.
Did you want to answer me?
Give me the question specifically.
Is bad behavior a character trait that we ought to apply when judging someone as a politician?
I think so. And you know, the sad part of it is most people are pretty good about judging people. They just don't take action. You know? They can get it to the ballot box.
But in terms of sex, the fact is we've had bad presidents who were on the straight and narrow in terms of their wives, and we've had good presidents who were fooling around. So there's really no correlation. Jimmy Carter is one president we can definitely say was entirely loyal, but an awful president. So there you go.
All right. And we have to be careful when we use the word straight here because, you know, this is a book about sex. And before we go to questions, when someone asked me to ask you this, Larry, which is basically in this era where we've sort of gone through a very strong feminist period, we're in sort of post-feminism or post-post-feminism. I'm not sure what that means, but my wife probably does. Where does Hustler fit in? you know, you're still doing what you did. I mean,
well,
larger.
My biggest arch enemy really is the feminists, but they've all been radicalized now. The normal people I get along with well. But in my speech that I give on college campuses, I attack people like Gloria Steinem, Annie Leibovitz, Andra Dworkin, and her cohorts in New York for really defeating the Equal Rights Amendment, the early 70s. We were only short one state in ratifying that Equal Rights Amendment. Had it passed, that would mean women who are now making 25% less than men doing the same job will be able to now be getting the same pay. So they screwed it up because they didn't take into consideration that feminists in Topeka, Kansas said also she liked being called a feminist and referred herself as a feminist, but she loved her husband and she enjoyed getting her three kids off for school of a day. Well, you see, that was not radical enough for Steinem and her friends. So I'll never forgive the feminists for really defeating the Equal Rights Amendment.
Okay. I suspect there might be some audience comment on that, but let's go to questions. Please remember it should end with a question mark, and please keep it as short as possible so we can get as many people up here. And let's start right over here.
Sure. A couple of things you said about 10 minutes ago really kind of tweaked me in my both feminist and hustler and Larry Flint-loving mind. And that is that I hear you saying things about men like it's just the personality style that's attracted to politics. They need approval. There are women in the audience, you know, and it's very hard to be monogamous for men. But about women, I hear you using words like manipulative and things like that. So you use this women who are cheated upon compromise, not for love, but because they're, like, manipulative to fulfill their own goals, whereas men are, like, powerful and stuff like that. It sounds a lot like, I don't know, things I don't really want to hear. So men who cheat are powerful and they can't help it, and women who either cheat or put up with cheating are manipulative?
Okay.
I mean, and both of you said it, Mr. Bronstein and Mr. Eisenbach.
Well, that wasn't what I intended to say.
It was
you know,
just the words
you
that
know,
came out initially.
You know, I suppose some could always like chop up anybody's words and then kind of turn them around. But the book and my feelings are that you know we're both men and women are operating not in a necessarily innocent place, right? So I wasn't trying to say men are innocent by any stretch of the imagination and women are manipulative. We're all manipulating each other in various ways.
Yeah,
so,
that was
yeah.
just like the overwhelming list of adjectives.
Yeah.
Very
well,
women
sorry.
Are very positive
that,
and well, can't
didn't,
help
I didn't
men.
Intend to say that. I didn't, that wasn't my point.
And since you also mentioned my transgressions here, I think Bobby Kennedy was one of the most manipulative human beings I've ever read about in my life. So I think we just probably didn't go down a long enough list to get the balance that
and
that
wait till
we
you
intend.
Read the J. Edgar Hoover
yeah,
chapter.
Yeah, read the book, and I think you'll find that it's very different.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
thank
so,
you very much.
You'll love it. You'll love it. There are a lot of very, very powerful, and what you're going to find in here is the best defense of Monica Lewinsky you're ever going to read in print.
Yeah. I can't wait.
A hero of the chapter, believe it or not.
A hero of Clinton's administration, too.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
When I was a kid learning history, we kept on reading that George Washington slept here, George Washington slept there. Was that a double entendre?
What is that?
George Washington sleep around.
If he did, it was awful slick. But you know what I found was interesting is that Jefferson and Washington was the only two founding fathers that never freed their slaves. We know why Jefferson didn't because he was doing them all. But another interesting take, which we really didn't dwell on in the book because there was no way of substantiating it, but it's been a theory that's been around over 200 years, is when George married Martha Washington, she was 27 years old and had two kids by a previous marriage. Well, they wanted desperately to have more children. They were unable to. Now, after the Revolutionary War, Washington was the most popular man in the country. He was a hero, a legend. He was everything that the colonies believed in. So if he would have wanted to be King George instead of president, he could have been. There's a school of thought that thinks because he couldn't produce an heir that he decided to go the presidential route. Now, we can't back that up. We can't back that up through research, but it's interesting to discuss occasionally, especially when we are able to document how desperate that they were to have additional children.
I am I'm naughty. I forgot I was supposed to say this before. As a reminder to our radio and internet audiences, tonight's Commonwealth Club program is a co-presentation with the club's Inform division, Connect Your Intellect. We're hosting One Nation Under Sex with publisher Larry Flint and Professor David Eisenbach. I'm Phil Bronstein, editor-at-large at Hearst Newspapers. So, having said that, let's go to the next question.
Thank you. Last month in San Francisco, a man's clothing caught fire in a peep show booth, and he suffered life-threatening third-degree burns to his upper body. And in Houston last year, a man died in a peep show booth, and his body was not found for 12 hours. How would the community address this safety issue while facing First Amendment questions of civil rights?
Safety issues and peep shows. I think probably. No, I
mean, yeah, it sounds like a serious
issue, but I'm not sure that anybody here is equipped to address that.
But whatever they could do to stop that from happening,
yes.
We're for it.
So you don't find it's a civil rights question. Thank you.
Over here.
With regards to women cheating, I was reading, I don't know, remember where, somewhere, that the rate of women cheating is starting to equal the rate of men cheating. And I think there is a power thing going on where powerful people like to cheat. And as women are making more money and becoming the breadwinners and, you know, just moving up the rungs of society, they're starting to cheat as much. I mean,
they're starting to admit it more, too.
That may be.
They're more comfortable admitting it,
too. Yes, that may be. But, I mean,
anyway.
A few generations ago, women weren't even thought to like sex. So maybe it is all an equal thing, and it's just not common knowledge yet.
That's right. And you're going to see this when you read the book, right? It was happening way back with the founding fathers, and Dolly Madison had quite the reputation. So it's going to be enlightening.
Yes, sir, over here.
So with Arnold having a baby with his indiscretions and John Edwards having a baby with his indiscretions, how many of the other people that you have in your book in the past actually had babies from their indiscretions? And what does that say about modern-day politicians? Haven't they heard about birth control?
Yeah. Thomas Jefferson, Grover Cleveland, Warren G. Harding, just to name three, all father children out of wedlock. And in the case of Grover Cleveland in 1884, it was well known. The essential argument of the Republican Party against Grover Cleveland is that he had this child out of wedlock. Grover Cleveland fully admitted it. And the all-male electorate elected him president anyway. In a strange way, we're more judgmental than our Victorian ancestors when it comes down to sex like that.
Thank you. I have to full disclosure here. This is Eve Burton, is the chief corporate counsel for the Hearst Corporation. I work for them. Eve is a huge First Amendment defender. We worked for years defending keeping reporters out of jails together. So, Eve, welcome. Your question.
Thank you, Phil. Larry, a question. You were speaking about Betty Friedan and her role in history in the ERA. What role do you think Helen Gurley Brown played? I mean, she was always seen as very controversial at the time as being anti-woman. And I'm wondering if you've thought at all about her role and what she did or didn't contribute to feminism and sex in America, again, in the 1960s.
What did she say?
Helen Gurley Brown, Sex and the Single Girl, 1960s. What did you do?
Helen Gurley Brown.
I think
Cosmopolitan. Remember Cosmopolitan?
What?
Magazine. Cosmopolitan magazine.
Yes, I think Helen Gurley Brown was Cosmopolitan magazine and the person who authored Sex and the Single Girl before she was given that title. I think she did more for the women's liberation movement than anybody on the planet. I think she contributed a great deal.
Hi, Larry. So much of your appeal is in revealing hypocrisy, more so than revealing details of individuals' sexual lives. But every time someone is shown to be hypocritical, I hope that it'll be somehow transformative, more so than on just them. You know, I think of Ted Haggard and Larry Craig being venomously anti-gay and being destroyed themselves, but not necessarily believing that revealing them has had a transformative impact on the issue. I think of politicians who are anti-immigrant, who are revealed to employ and benefit from illegal immigrants, and so forth. So I wonder, besides being personally ruinous, when you reveal someone being hypocritical, what other impacts do you see or hope to see on society?
Would suggest that.
What's the bigger social impact of the outing of
if you did what?
Hypocritical politicians, like David Vitter and
Larry what
Craig.
About?
What's the bigger impact?
Meaning the individual.
Well, I'd like to think I'm doing a service, but if not for the country, I'm doing it for myself, because that's the only way I can have political effect, okay? Otherwise, I got one vote. But if I can be part of that revolving door, you know, I'm happy to help them through it.
Thanks.
Thank you. Over here.
Mr. Flint, I'm from Lynchburg, Virginia, hometown of Jerry Falwell. And I was just wondering if you could reflect any on your personal interactions with Mr. Falwell.
Falwell. Good memory of Falwell.
Falwell preached against me for 15 years on the old time gospel hour. And he blamed me for every ill that society embodied. So we did an ad parody, a comparative ad parody. So what we said, like, he got sliced before he preached, and his first sexual encounter was with his mother in an outhouse. This was clearly parody, okay? But unfortunately, parody was not protected under the First Amendment or the Constitution of the United States. So after losing at the trial level, losing at the circuit level, and going to the Supreme Court, I won a unanimous decision. And it all boiled down to this. The jury found no libel, but they wanted me to give Falwell $250,000 because I hurt his feelings. Now that means you settle a case like that, that means somebody's going to sue you and you hurt his wife's feelings or his dog's feelings or his kid's feelings, you know. I mean, that can't be any type of criteria that involves the First Amendment. Well, I was happy to win that case, and for those of you who don't know, that case is taught in law schools throughout America as the premier First Amendment case.
Just by the way, if Larry Flynn didn't win that case, we would not have political satire on Saturday Night Live. Jon Stewart wouldn't have a job. Bill Maher wouldn't have a job. A lot of people owe a lot and their careers to this man here.
Now, Larry, you and Falwell kind of had a bearing of the hatchet at the end of his life, right?
Well, after I beat him real good, then he wanted to meet with me, and I always remember something my mother said. She said, no matter how much you think you despise someone, if you sit down and talk to them, you'll always find certain qualities that you can like. So I agreed with the meeting with Falwell. It lasted for 3 hours, and I disagree with everything he stands for, everything he says, you know. But, you know, I realized that he was just, he used to call me and seek advice after that. And I don't know if you remember this story. One time, he had this press conference and had the Teletubbies out there, and he said they were gay because the colors they wear, the purple, you know. So the press takes out after him in a big way, you know, about, hey, this preacher, he ain't got nothing better to do than say the Teletubbies are gay. So he called me, and I said, Jerry, I said, you're the most famous evangelist in the world. I said, what in the hell are you doing? I said, why does it matter if the Teletubbies are gay? They're only puppets. So that was Jerry Falwell.
Yes, question over here.
Just a quick question. Early on, you said that you called Edwards, you described his dalliance as bad. And I'm wondering if there's any, it implied that you made a moral judgment, and it was beyond his being hypocritical. And I'm wondering if there's any time in which someone having sex you would call bad, or why.
John Edwards. Well, let me address that. When you're cheating on your wife and she's, stricken with cancer, that's pretty bad. Even worse. He knows that he's got this problem. He's got this child. And yet, he still continues to run for the Democratic Party nomination. What if he had won that nomination, and then all of a sudden, in the summer and fall of 2008, it comes out that, he's got this child out of wedlock, right? That brings down the Democratic Party. That is the height of arrogance, selfishness, and foolishness in the middle of one of the most important presidential campaign in our lifetime, right? So that kind of mentality, well, that's just bad, right?
You have a question over here?
Completely non-political question. Larry, have you ever been or tried to be monogamous? And if so, were you successful?
I'm glad she's not asking me. Anyway, did you ever try being monogamous? And were you successful?
I've been like the Energizer Bunny all my life. And I feel at some point I will no longer be able to cut the mustard, so I'll just lick the jar.
That'll happen.
Well,
on that note, no, we got
to. I don't know. Okay, we have time for one more. I hate to step on that line, but we got time for one more really brief question, really brief answer.
I don't want to rain on any parade, but you're condemning Jonathan Edwards. Why don't you get into the fact? I was there. I had a wife with ovarian cancer. I've been always faithful, loyal. It's been 4 or 5 years. All anybody ever did was, how is Ellen? No one ever thought about my particular needs. And, I won't tell a gesture at something that I did, and I felt very neglected. And we had a maid in the house, and that was that. So until you understand motivations and the loneliness that comes with a wife who you love and been with you, I think you cannot be accusatory.
Fair enough. But you understand about, running for president of the United States, right, could have dragged down the party and we would have been sitting with John McCain as president of the United States.
Okay.
All right.
Point taken. Okay. We have, is your question like one sentence? Okay. Go ahead.
Talk briefly about the rise of Facebook and the sharing that the internet is bringing.
Okay, I hate to do this to you, but we can't because we're really out of time. Right. And we do this newly founded Inforum tradition that we ask all our speakers the following question. Sorry about that. So, Larry and David, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world? So you got 60 seconds to say what your idea is to change the world.
60 seconds. What would you do to change the world?
Try to incorporate a system like they have in Australia where you're fined if you don't vote. You're going to need an act of Congress to do that. But I think if you force people to make a decision, they'll think about it longer, and they'll make the right decision. After all, if you're going to live in a democracy and enjoy the fruits of this democracy, then you should participate in it. That's my feeling. And I think if we could get the government on track for something like that and see that everybody that's eligible to vote, votes.
stop judging people based on who they want to sleep with and how they have sex, and let's just get back to what we need to be focused on politically, and that's the real threats that threaten our country.
Okay, I think it's been a great evening. Let's give a round of applause to Larry Flynt and Professor David Eisenbach for sharing their thoughts. I'm Phil Bronstein. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you very much.